is United States of America versus Edwards. And we'll hear first from Mr. Edwards' attorney.
Good morning. Margaret Foldis, Assistant Federal Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Edwards. May it please the court. The Supreme Court's Erlinger decision has made a vast change to the ACCA legal landscape by requiring the government to prove the different occasions requirement to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And it has impacted Mr. Edwards' case in two significant ways. First, it has rendered his plea involuntary. And second, it violated his Fifth and Sixth Amendment jury trial rights. The government does not dispute that there is an Erlinger issue here and that there is error. It concedes that Mr. Edwards never pled to the different occasions issue, and it concedes that a jury never decided the issue either. With respect to his plea, Mr. Edwards admitted to three simple elements, and they were as follows based on what the prosecutor said at the plea. He said, first, the defendant knowingly possessed a firearm and ammunition. Second, that prior to the defendant possessing the firearm and ammunition, that those items had moved in interstate or foreign commerce. And third, that prior to that date, the defendant knew that he had previously been convicted of a crime that is punishable by more than 1 year in prison, in other words, a felony. And then the prosecutor told the judge, those are the three elements, Your Honor. So from Mr. Edwards' point of view at the plea, those are the three elements that he was pleading to, and those are the three elements that the court was telling him the government would have to prove if he decided to go to a trial. Notably missing was the different occasions issue, which he had an absolute right to take to trial and to have the government prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Due process requires that a plea for the defendant, he has to enter a plea knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. And a guilty plea is involuntary when the defendant does not know all the elements of the crime to which he's pleading to. So, and that issue is reviewed de novo, and it's very clear in this case that he absolutely didn't know that he had a right to go to trial on the different occasions issue.
So, but did he not, in adopting and then not objecting to the plea, admit to that he was subject to the enhancement?
At the time that he had his plea, we didn't have Erlinger, so we had a different version of ACCA.
True. Well, I mean, what you didn't yet have is a statement from the Supreme Court that the different occasions requirement is factual and thus has to be either proven beyond a reasonable doubt or admitted, right? And did he not admit, in admitting that he's subject to the enhancement, does he not, especially in a case like this where there were only three ACCA predicates listed, did he not effectively admit to those three predicates that they were on different occasions?
He didn't, because Erlinger case actually changed the elements of ACCA. So he could not admit to an element that he was unaware of and that did not exist at the time. It didn't exist. So he wasn't admitting to that. He gets the benefit of Erlinger because he's on direct appeal. So he, whatever his lawyer may have said about ACCA and adopting ACCA at the time, and I don't think that's what he said at the plea. He might have said some of that stuff at the sentencing, but whatever his lawyer was saying at that time was to a different version of ACCA, had different elements. And again, the lawyer is not...
The statute has been rewritten?
It has different elements based on Erlinger.
But yes, so Erlinger sort of infuses the statute with new understanding. But I just want to make sure that I'm clear. You're not telling me that in the wake of Erlinger, the statute has been rewritten?
Obviously not, no. But I am saying that there is now a new element. It's been interpreted by the Supreme Court to have this as an element where the government has to actually go to trial and prove it. And so when the lawyer was talking about whatever it exactly he said about adopting or admitting to ACCA in general, he wasn't admitting to the current ACCA as we know it. And again, that is the one that applies to Mr. Edwards' case. It's the current version because he's on direct appeal. So whatever old version the lawyer may have been referring to, it's not the current version, and it does not encompass an admission to ACCA as we know it today.
Help me with this, Ms. Foldis. Do we have to review at least the first two issues you raised for plain error?
You're speaking about the Fifth and Sixth Amendment jury trial, right? Is that right?
I'm talking about beyond the jury trial issue. You have a number of issues with regard to Who has the burden in this case of establishing that with regard to the three felony convictions, two didn't occur on the same day? Normally the government would have that burden, but you didn't raise it. Have the burdens flipped around? Is any of this reviewed for plain error? Any of the issues you've raised,
so the fifth,
are any of them reviewed for plain error is what I'm asking. As I understand it, you say the guilty plea was not entered knowingly and voluntarily because Edwards incorrectly believes he was preserving the right to appeal the denial of his motion to suppress. Then you argue that whether the question was whether the district court erred in imposing a 15-year mandatory minimum under 924E1 because the government failed to prove that Edwards had three qualifying prior convictions for a violent felony or a serious drug offense. Third, whether Edwards' sentence plainly violated the Fifth and Sixth Amendment because the district court enhanced it under ACCA without examining the facts. And then, of course, you had the issue about 922G.
So I'll just take
were one. Any of these, at least the first three, do we review any of them at this point for plain error in your view?
For the issue of voluntariness of the plea, that is de novo. That's our position, is de novo, because he attempted to raise it in the district court, and so it's been preserved. And the argument that we're now making with Erlinger is an extension of that first argument about the voluntariness of the plea. Under Yee versus Escondido, we can make an extension of an argument that of an issue that has already been raised. And so the second issue changed, actually. Second and third issue changed once Erlinger came out. So because now you have this intervening authority. So those issues are governed by plain error, but I've also submitted to the court in connection with the plain error test that structural error actually applies. I submitted that on Friday, and it's a case, United States versus Cogdill out of the Sixth Circuit. The majority does not agree with that, but the dissent explains the reasoning very well. And I'm going to rest on that letter for the structural error argument and just proceed under the third, because the government has conceded that the first two prongs right. of plain error are met.
So and prejudice has to be established by you.
That's correct. But the test for what we're looking at right now is a reasonable probability that the defendant would have gone to trial. That's under the Gary case. So that's what we have to prove. We don't have
Let
to prove.
Let me ask you, is there any evidence in this record that he would have gone to trial if he had known?
Yes, there's a ton of evidence in the record.
Tell me, just cite for me what evidence I can find other than a statement by the lawyer at the sentencing colloquy.
You just have to look at the PSI, because if Mr. Edwards is trying to evaluate whether he's going to trial or not, he's looking at what the government has to take to trial. That's how they evaluate it. That's how it's evaluated in Gary.
No, I understand the argument. I'm asking a slightly different question. What evidence is there from the defendant that he would otherwise have gone to trial if he had known that he couldn't appeal from the denial of the suppression? Does he say anything? Is there an affidavit? Does he say anything to the judge? Is there any statement, just bear with me, is there any statement of any kind from the defendant that if indeed he knew or realized he couldn't plead, he couldn't preserve that issue, he would not have entered a plea? And if the answer is no, don't you have to show that in some way or form?
As far as the suppression motion goes, and I'm relying on the briefs for that part of the voluntariness argument, I'm really focusing on the Erlinger aspect for the voluntariness.
I understand. I'm just asking a specific question of whether there's any evidence, if you could cite it.
Right. And I think that there's two different answers for the different arguments, because for the voluntariness with respect to the suppression motion, there are indications in the record at the end of either the plea or the sentencing where Mr. Edwards is expressing through his lawyer that he wants to appeal his motion to suppress. So that on the record,
but that's not quite the same thing as saying If I couldn't appeal it, I want my plea back and I want to go to trial.
Well, he did the best he could.
No, but counsel could have said, could he not? And if he can't appeal from the suppression, he wants his plea back, Judge.
Well, but the court told him he could. So there was no reason for the lawyer to say if he can't, because the court actually said, okay, yeah, there's no appellate waiver. You can do that just
of course, the irony five. Is nobody remembered what was in the plea agreement. Well, but they didn't even remember that. Bear with me.
Sorry.
They didn't even remember that there was a plea agreement.
Correct. But the court looked back at the record and said, here's a plea agreement. There's no appellate waiver. You can raise that, Mr. Edwards, as long as you comply with your deadlines. So there was no reason for the lawyer to say, well, if he can't, because the court already told him he could. And that is what I am.
So that's the evidence.
That is the evidence. Yes, it is for the voluntariness.
Right. I'm talking about an issue on the voluntariness of the plea.
Based on the motion to suppress, because the second issue is the voluntariness based on earlier. And the evidence for that is based because of the test that we're looking at with earlier for going to trial, the Fifth and Sixth Amendment jury trial part. What you're looking at in the record is to determine whether the defendant would go to trial. And the way under Gary that a defendant would figure that out is he would look at what the government has to take the trial and decide whether it's a good idea to go. In the Gary case, it wasn't a good idea because it's pretty obvious that if he's going on the whole theory that he's going to prove to the jury that he didn't remember that he was a felon, he's going to lose. So he's not going to trial on that. But on Erlinger, it's a whole different thing.
All right. So let me ask you a question about that. Just hypothetically, if we were to agree with you that there is a problem in the sentencing under Erlinger, but we disagreed with you on the plea, the voluntariness of the plea, would that be the same result regardless?
No, because the remedy for the plea would be to send it back and let him go to trial. The remedy for the Fifth and Sixth Amendment part of it is that he would be sent back without an ACCA enhancement.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So all right. I guess I'm in the red, sorry.
And you've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Ms. Adams.
May it please the court, Ann O'Connell Adams for the United States. We'll start with Erlinger, since that's where we started in the first part of the argument, and I'm happy to talk about the other issues as well. There's two Erlinger arguments at this point. One is the straight Erlinger issue, and then one is the voluntariness of the plea based on Erlinger. Both of those are reviewed for plain error.
Let me ask you a question, though, because the way I understand it is, if we can't tell by looking at the Shepherd documents that the proposed predicate convictions occurred on different occasions, then that's the government's problem. That's not the defendant's problem. First of all, my question for you is, do you disagree with that? And if so, on what basis? And second, if you don't disagree with that, why don't you have that problem here, given that the Shepherd documents you all relied on were the PSR, and it says about one of these, the circumstances of this arrest were requested from the Broward County Clerk of Courts and are pending receipt. And that's pretty much all that it says.
To start with the first part, Judge Rosenbaum, I do disagree with the premise. I don't think it's the government's burden at this point in the litigation to prove that the prior convictions took place on different occasions. This is under plain error. We agree that there was an error here, a Fifth and Sixth Amendment error under Erlinger, and that it's the Supreme Court's decision and Erlinger makes it plain. But at the third step of the analysis, it's the defendant that has to show that the error affected his substantial rights and that he must show a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different but for this error.
Right,
so he would have to do that by showing that the offenses were committed on different occasions.
I'm not sure that's right, though, because the burden is always on the government to show that this isn't a habeas case. This is direct appeal. And so the government, you would agree with me that the government would bear the burden at sentencing to show that the crimes were committed on different occasions, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, the problem is that now we're on we're on direct appeal. So I'm not understanding where the burden switch comes from, because there's nothing in the record that the government can point to here that shows that they were on different occasions. If the government had something it could point to, I would absolutely agree with you. Then the burden would switch to the defendant. But there's nothing that I see in the record that shows that two of the convictions necessarily occurred on, you know, were from different occasions.
The burden switch comes from the plain error standard. So he has to show a reasonable probability that he would have received a lower sentence, but for this error. And the record does support the idea that these are different. In Wooden, there's three factors that Wooden identified to show that whether crimes took place on different occasions. It's the timing, it's the location, and then it's the character and nature of the offense. So here we just don't have information about the first two. We know when the assault crime took place in October of 2010, and we know the county where both of the crimes took place, and that's the same. We don't know when the drug crime took place, but these two crimes are not at all similar to what's going on in Wooden. One of them is a drug distribution crime. One of them is a domestic assault, breaking a flower pot over somebody's head. They're not.
I understand where you're coming from on that, and might turn out very easily that they are different occasions when you go back on remand, if that were to happen. But I mean, you've just conceded that on the two of the three prongs, you can't say anything about it. And on the third, if you're doing it just based on the nature of the offense, like that seems like that's a problem for you. I don't see how the government can show that they were that they were committed on different occasions. Oh. And I think it is the government's burden to show that here, because that's where the error comes in, right? The error is that, it's not clear whether they were committed on separate occasions. And if they were committed on separate occasions, there's no question it affects his substantial rights.
Correct. But I think Wooden says that one factor can be dispositive. And in this case, that last factor, whether the crimes are interrelated, these are not crimes that are obviously intertwined, like multiple drug offenses taking place.
It's true, but it's not necessarily the case that they're not intertwined. I mean, it could be that, you know, I mean, who knows what happened here? Maybe the victim was involved in the drug trafficking issue, and there was, and this was sort of fallout from the arrest or a bad transaction. I mean, that could be.
It could be. There's lots of, it could be that they took place on the same day. It could be that they, took place in the same
right.
house.
And so if the government, let me put it this way, would you agree that then the answer to this comes down to whose burden it is to show?
Yes,
absolutely. Whose burden it is to show that they occurred on different occasions?
Yes. And that's generally the government's burden, but not when it's being reviewed on plain error. On plain error, he's got to make some kind of a showing that, in fact, there's a reasonable probability that they did take place on the same occasion. And I want to point the court to Greer, the Supreme Court's decision in Greer, which we cited in our supplemental brief on Erlinger. This was a post-Rehaif case. So after the Supreme Court held that 922 G1 requires the government to prove that the defendant knew he was a convicted felon at the time he possessed a firearm, the Supreme Court took a follow-on case, Greer, about applying plain error to Rehaif errors. And there were two defendants in that case, one who had been convicted in a jury trial and one who had pleaded guilty. And the defendant who pleaded guilty said in the plea colloquy, nobody told me that there was a mens rea element, and they were trying to argue plain error on that ground. What the majority opinion says there is that one of the key things in rejecting both defendants' claims is that the defendants never even made an assertion in their briefs that they didn't know that they were convicted felons. And translating that to here, there's never been an assertion. I mean, it supports the idea
But here's the problem, right? The problem is that before Erlinger, you didn't know that. You didn't know that one of the elements, I guess, was that the three priors occurred on different occasions. The You didn't know that. So you could stipulate that that was fulfilled, that the three priors were fulfilled, and think and believe that they, it could be fulfilled by having occurred on two different occasions or one occasion, right? And in the Rehafe follow-on cases, Greer, whatever, the question was whether you knew you were a felon. And, you know, that whether you knew that you were a felon seems like a very different question, because obviously if you've been convicted in of a crime that you've spent more than a year in jail on, or that you could have spent a year in jail on, you would know that. But in the situation with Erlinger, because of the different elements of the different factors that we have to consider in determining whether convictions were committed on different occasions, you wouldn't necessarily know that. And in fact, we're standing here talking about it. We don't know today. And there could be situations where it's a close call as to whether they were committed on different occasions. And so it seems very different to me, the situation in Greer versus the situation here.
They don't seem that different to me, because the defendant would know in either case. I mean, yes, there is some kind of a factual inquiry that you're making under Wooden that applies.
It's actually factors. Kind of a legal. I mean, it's yes, it's a question of fact, but it also involves sort of a legal analysis, right? You've got to look at these different factors. You've got to consider them together, and you've got to decide, okay, as a matter of really, I mean, it's, I guess as a matter of fact, but it's really kind of also as a matter of law, are these committed on different occasions? Are they separate and distinct units?
Yes. I mean, I think it is a factual question. And it's all information that, just like the knowledge of whether you're a felon or not, they're all things that the defendant would know: what date he committed the offenses, where they were committed, et cetera. He might not know that third element, whether the legal element.
Right, and that overlap, makes it different.
But that
he
one
wouldn't
is-
know that there were those three elements that, I mean, there's no way that anybody would have known at the time of this guilty plea, or even just at the time of the sentencing, that these were the three elements we were going to, or these were the three factors we were going to look to determine whether the convictions had occurred on different occasions, let alone the fact that they had to have occurred on different occasions. And that, to me, makes it very different from whether or not you happen to know you were convicted of a felony. It's not just so simple and straightforward.
Right. I don't think the issues are actually that different, because if one of the factors under Wooden is whether they were convicted on different dates, and surely the defendant would know if he committed the domestic assault on the same date as the drug trafficking.
That's a different question, though, right? Whether they were committed on different dates versus whether he was convicted on different dates, and whether they were kind of tied together.
Right. And he was convicted on different dates. We don't know the information about when he committed each crime, which is the crime, one of the things that you would need to know and could be totally dispositive here. And that's within the defendant's knowledge. It's just never alleged in the briefs that that these were committed on the same occasion. It's the government's burden to prove at the outset, but once we get flipped to plain error, which we are here, then it's the defendant that has to show.
Well, help me understand the burdens, which seems to be the critical question in this case. Is it your view in this case that you have no burden at all with regard to these three felonies as to the timing?
That's right. Under the plain error standard, the third prong is...
You have to show nothing here. The entire burden rests with the defendant.
On plain error review.
Right.
Yes.
Notwithstanding what Erlinger said, when it said it, and so on and so forth.
That's right. The defendant has the burden to prove plain error. We've conceded prongs one and two, but it's the substantial rights prong where the rubber meets the road here. Whether there's a reasonable probability that a different sentence would have been imposed but for the Erlinger error, and that's defendant's burden.
Right. So it all boils down to who has the burden of persuasion.
That's correct.
If you have it, you lose. You agree?
No, I think we do still have information here from which I mean, I think if we were to go to trial on this, we may not have enough evidence. We'd probably need to shore up some.
No, but if you had the burden, if this issue had been squarely raised, squarely flagged,
yes,
et cetera, you would have had the burden.
Exactly.
Period.
Yes.
And if you didn't put forward enough evidence to establish the nature, timeliness, and of the plea, et cetera, of these prior crimes, you would lose.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the only reason you don't lose, you say, is because Ms. Folda's client has the burden.
That's right.
Okay.
On the second part of the argument.
I'm sorry. They have the burden to show that it affected substantial rights. There's no question about that. But it's sort of a nuanced question here, because the way that they show it affected substantial rights is to show that the government didn't prove that it occurred on different occasions, and that you can't tell from looking at this that it occurred on different occasions.
I don't think that's exactly the right way to look at it. And under Greer, there's a passage where, you know, the Supreme Court says, you know, yes, you can look throughout the record to determine what the factual issue is, but they also say, you know, the defendant, the one that had gone to trial, is asking you to imagine that the jury had been instructed correctly, but that the government didn't introduce additional evidence to prove that Greer knew he was a felon, and that's not a realistic scenario. So if we all knew that that we had to prove this at the outset, which we didn't, then the government could have gone and filled out the
evidence. I understand. But so now that brings us to the second question, right? Which is, what is in the record to show that these occurred on different occasions?
And I think the answer to that is that they're completely different crimes. They're not crimes that are obviously intertwined, a domestic assault and a drug trafficking offense. And then we also we don't know that they took place on the same day or at the same location. There's not information about those other prongs. So there's nothing really going the other way. The arrest didn't even happen on the same day. So, and Wooden does say that one factor can be dispositive. And here we think—
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's say we have a situation where we don't know the first two like we have here. And the third one, let's say it's another drug crime. Okay. In that case, would the government's position be that that there was no plain error that affected substantial rights?
If we didn't have any information about the timing, then I think we probably wouldn't have enough there.
Like, right. Okay. Yeah. So why is this different then? Because the only thing that makes it different is that you've got a domestic violence crime, but we've already talked about how they could be related. Why is this different?
I think it's different because it's just not the type of thing that was going on in Wooden. They're not obviously intertwined, and that's what the Supreme Court was looking for in Wooden and Erlinger in describing these types of errors.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll hear again from Ms. Foldis.
Thank you. I just want to try and make this a little simpler with respect to the plain error burden. Obviously on the defendant, okay? But the question is, what do we have to prove to meet our burden? And what I think was going wrong here is that the government is saying that we have a burden to prove that they're the same occasion. And that's not the question. The question is, would the defendant have gone to trial?
But that's the question on the first issue, not the second issue.
That's the
question on the plea issue. It's not the question on the sentencing issue.
No, it's actually a question on the sentencing issue. Whether or not he would have gone to trial had he been informed of all the elements of his crime, if he had understood what it was.
Isn't there also another question on the sentencing issue, which is whether if he had gone to trial or not, whatever, whether he would have had a different sentence?
Well, okay, so they're citing to a 2014 case, Jones, back in the day before you would have to take this issue into a trial. So back then, there wasn't a question of whether or not the defendant would go to a trial. Back then, it was the question of whether he would have gotten a different sentence. But now that we have Erlinger, according to Greer, which they cite, we're all talking about the same case here, on page 508, they say what the burden is for the guy who pled guilty. It's Gary. He's the guy. It says Gary has the burden on plain error here of showing that the district court had correctly advised him of the mens rea element of the offense, that there is a reasonable probability he would not have pled guilty. That's what the burden is. So the reason the government, comes out with the result it does is because they're asking the wrong question. They're looking back at a 2014 case before Erlinger came out, before there was a trial.
So help me sort this out then. Again, hypothetically, let's say that we don't think the plea was involuntary, but we do think that there's a problem under Erlinger with the sentencing.
Right.
Okay. So under that scenario, then what happens is it goes back for resentencing, right?
Yeah. Yes. And at that time, he can decide to go to trial on the ACCA issue.
Right.
So, and under Greer.
So does it matter? This gets me back to my first question, which is, does it really matter whether how we turn out on the first issue as a practical matter, if we come out on the second issue, that there's an Erlinger problem?
I actually view it as kind of like a remedy issue, you know? So whether it's reversed on the fifth and sixth jury trial, right, and you send it back so that he can be resentenced and then he can have a trial on that, I guess it is kind of the same result. But the important thing I'm trying to say is the critical issue here is who's got the burden. And the defendant has a burden on plain error, but the burden is to show reasonable probability that the defendant would have gone to trial on this issue. And it's clear from the record that he would have, because there isn't anything that the government has in that record. They never produced anything that was admissible. When he's looking at the record, he's saying, this is a good case. This is a triable issue. And I did give the court a 28J letter on a case that just happened last week in the Southern District of Florida. It's the United States versus Martin case. I provided the court with some of the transcript of that trial, because this whole issue about what they can bring in a trial is very clear and is really brought into focus through the Martin case. The judge, first of all, the government came to trial because they're used to just relying on these documents. They came to trial with three judgments. One of them didn't get into evidence because it was based on a nolo plea. And under Federal Rule of Evidence 803.22, it just doesn't come in. And the other two that did come in, the judge had this to say. He's looking at certified judgments that have been put into evidence. And he says, I have read them. I don't see one thing that tells me when the offenses were committed, how they were committed. I can't tell the difference, how you tell the difference from one to the other. And a little bit later, he tells the prosecutor, you should have been able to give me the factual background of each of these violations, told me when it happened, how it happened, the nature of the offense. And then the jury can make the determination based on all of those factors. They don't have the factors, and they're not getting the factors, because the judgment only shows when the conviction happened, not when the crime happened. It only shows where the conviction was, where the courthouse was, not where the crime happened.
All right,
it doesn't show
you
the facts. So
thanks. I think we have your argument.
Thank you very much.